Welcome to the Secure Serengeti Podcast. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about cybersecurity and technology news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
We would like to announce our retirement from cybersecurity. We are leaving to start a farm.
A dairy farm.
FYI, apologize in advance for any weird audio. We are recording again in a restaurant. I swear to God, like 15 minutes ago, wasn't it kind of quiet?
Yeah.
Like I was just sitting here listening. I was like, oh, right, this will be the perfect time to start.
Well, and then they seated people on opposite sides of us, too.
Yeah, and there's like a herd of people that came in.
What time was it? And this is past the lunch hour.
Yeah, it was like 1:20. I would have expected it to start slowing down, but hello. All right, today we have three articles that all basically say the same thing. There is no cybersecurity job gap in security right now, at least not the kind that can be addressed by colleges and boot camps. Instead, what we have is a skills gap around certain specialties. The Venture in Security article calls out that engineers, folks who can build things, specifically software, are in high demand and salaries are still high. What he calls quote-unquote operators are not in high demand. These are the folks who may have the job title engineer, but don't build, they administer, and this also includes risk analysts, SOC analysts, that type of thing. So why are we saying there's not a gap when there clearly is? There are millions of blog posts and news articles complaining about the gap. It's obvious it exists.
In the Cyber is Full article, the author claims that cybersecurity as an industry is oversaturated with practitioners, mainly due to boot camps, universities, and certification factories that have produced too many. Now, I kind of agree with this, what they've really produced is a promise, not actual cybersecurity professionals. So you have folks who want to or claim they want to become cybersecurity professionals. Not that they actually become them after attending these boot camps or certifications or even the university. And the author claims that the chief drivers of this are running schools and boot camps and trying to generate a market for their own product.
So I actually fell for this. I was encouraging my son last year to take a programming boot camp versus going to college. I assumed that it was going to be more of a trade school thing, which I think programming probably is more of a trade school thing than a college thing. But maybe I was wrong.
Yeah, I still think HVAC would be better.
I don't disagree, actually. Like, that is not going to go away with I.
No, you've got to have a person there. Yeah. If you do HVAC, then you do electrical, plumbing, basically.
You do a little bit of everything.
So even if you don't have an HVAC job position, you could do electrical work or you could do plumbing work.
The main number used for the gap, what's being thrown around a lot is 4 million or 4.8 million, is generated by the ISC Squared, which is a certification organization. There's no conflict of interest there. A certification org saying that they need to get more people certified to get hired for these jobs?
Well, you know, it's not for ISC Squared. Well, maybe it's just the CP that has the five-year requirement.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can get like the associate of CISP, and they've got another one that's like got a 2-year requirement that nobody pays attention to.
Well, I think, you know, they start off with the CISP with that 5-year requirement. And now since they've added on
other entry level stuff
to get other people in the door. Because before with the CISP, there was no incentive really for people who weren't already in the industry to get the certification. So now they've got these other ones, which are now incentivizing people to get into the industry.
It's been such a, we talked about certifications like 3 years ago at this point, but there's been such an incredible proliferation of certifications. You can get dozens and dozens if you wanted to try and do that.
Yeah, I love seeing people's signature blocks that have a list of their certifications in there. It makes me really trust them more as far as their qualifications go.
I think I told you once, I interviewed somebody and I asked him what his goals for like learning were, and he just told me a list of certifications he wanted to get. Like for him, certifications were learning. Like they were simul, they were the same thing. And there's an overlap there, but it's not the same thing.
Well, those are very ephemeral, really. The knowledge that you acquire through the acquisition
long
of certifications.
Long enough to memorize to take the tests.
Right.
Yeah.
Really, you're gonna maintain that for a couple months. Couple of months, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
You really learn from, practicing versus, you know, studying or whatever.
What's interesting about that is that companies will send you to a training course, and they'll expect you to. But then they don't give you the chance to practice to like drive those skills in. They'll just send you to kind of a course, and frequently it may not be a course that's even related to your job duties. I don't know. We're just we'll talk more about the training stuff later, but we're doing a terrible job at it.
But the gap between the active workforce and what ISC squared says is the perceived unmet need for cybersecurity grew 19% to $4.8 million jobs globally. So the new cybersecurity job postings in the U.S. declined 5.4% over a year as of May, according to LinkedIn. So the gap between how many people we think we need versus the number of actual positions is what we're talking about.
So how does ISC squared come up with the number they think we need?
Oh, well, you ask any, so, you know, how many people do you need? They're going to say, you know, what their dream count is versus what the actual number of open billets they have on it.
3,000 or 4,000 should get us there.
Yeah. Well, for every elementary school, 3,000 or 4,000 should cover it.
So additionally, the author points out that since security is technically optional, our jobs tend to be a lot more inconsistent than someone who's producing something that the company can make money on. Some companies take a chance, and for many years, they draw into the straight and never get a breach.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is cybersecurity is overhead. And there are a lot of unqualified people that are claiming to be cybersecurity professionals attempting to fill a shrinking pool of cybersecurity jobs. In a Venture in Security article, the author addresses the difficulty that many entry-level cybersecurity folks have when trying to break into the industry. Apparently there are influencers.
Influencers is such a cancer.
It's ridiculous. But they're shouting that the industry is gatekeeping them out. But you know, why would anybody be influenced by such a moronic concept?
Yeah, he agrees that the major part of the disconnect has been created by colleges and boot camps trying to sell that fantasy of the starting six-figure job, which exists, but it exists in very small quantities. I mean,
very niche
and
scenarios.
Not in cybersecurity. Like, we work in the DC area. I don't think you start off in the DC area making six figures anywhere. I've heard 80,000 to 90,000, which is close, but.
Well, I don't know of any hiring manager who would take someone off the street
fresh out of college and give them six figures. Yeah.
It just seems like the return on investment there is pretty low.
Yeah. The same thing happened with MCSEs in the late 90s. I was in college at the time, and I remember my freshman year in college, everybody was talking about, you got to get that IT degree, you got to get that MCSE, and then you'll be making that six-figure job right out of college. It happened with lawyers in the early 2000s. There's a gap. Then some industry gets word of the gap and they try and spin up to try and sell folks on filling that gap, which then floods it and drives down salaries. Just supply and demand.
Yep. And having worked with MCSEs in the early 2000s, they were not pumping out high quality folks in that time frame either.
Yeah. He calls out that getting a job in cybersecurity shouldn't be an entry level role. It should be a specialization down the road after some number of years in IT, developing that prerequisite knowledge. I've interviewed personally a number of folks for entry level. I used to manage a SOC. I've interviewed a bunch of people for entry level SOC positions, and I've generally been disappointed. There have been very few. I can count them on one hand that I've been impressed with after the interview and been like, yeah, this guy's going to be a great SOC analyst.
Yeah. Well, back in the early days of cybersecurity, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that's where all the cybersecurity people actually came from is IT, because there was no industry. There was no, I mean, you had the CISSP, which started in the late 90s, but you know, that was not something that someone got in order to break into cybersecurity. That's something someone who'd been doing cybersecurity, you know, got in order to validate their qualifications. But yeah, most cybersecurity people came from IT back in the day.
Yeah. And I mean, even myself, didn't get into cybersecurity until 2011. And even then, that was after 3 years working in an IT role. And I knew I wanted to get into cybersecurity in 2008 when I decided to career change. And I knew that I had to get an IT job first. I didn't try to get into cybersecurity first.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm the exception then, because I started in security and then switched into cybersecurity into doing IT stuff.
Oh, so that's still kind of like you came from a security background. I feel like that still is kind of, you didn't start off like fresh out of getting out of the military. Although in the military, they do teach you things, so that's still not. All right.
Anyway.
So there are actual shortages in cybersecurity, as we mentioned at the beginning, but they're not in the entry-level position, they're in the specializations. So according to Ben Rothke, the jobs that are in high demand include engineers who can actually build something. Not implement something, not administer something. Those are both valuable, but they're less valuable than people that can build something from nothing. There are a ton of folks who have the engineer job title. And these days it seems the engineer job title is more for salary differentiation than for actual job responsibilities.
Yep. We've talked about this before where you go from analyst one, two to engineer. There's not an analyst three, four, et cetera.
I mean, my job title is engineer and I am implementing things, but I'm not building things from scratch. Like I'm in charge of projects where we implement a service, which is more valuable than maybe just administering the service, but it's less valuable than someone who can actually like build a product from scratch.
Right.
Yeah. Other things that are in demand, anyone in security who can code worth a damn, so I'm out. And that's funny because we both tried this. You tried this before I did. Trying to get analysts to code is impossible if they don't want to code.
Well, what's ridiculous is I actually taught a class, Introduction to Python, and it was a voluntary class. Analysts went to the class, and then after the class was over, I gave them a task. Actually, analyst tasks work to use the programming that they learned in the class to analyze a problem. And they simply refused, literally refused to use Python in order to analyze this problem. They used Excel instead. And I was upset. Yeah, because it's just ridiculous.
And what's interesting about this is that everybody has learned that if you're asked about coding in a job interview, you have to have something. Like everybody that I've ever asked, like, oh, do you code? They're like, oh, I Python. But then when you hire them, they inevitably don't use it as a problem solving method in their job, which I kind of understand. I've tried to do that myself. And part of it is because, well, at least in my case, I'm unpracticed and it's difficult finding the time in the job where you can be like, all right, I'm going to take three times as long to perform this task because I'm going to do it in Python, but that's going to pay dividends because the next time it's only going to take me 2.5 times. The next time it's only going to take me 2 times. And then eventually I'll get more efficient. But it's interesting. We seem to be very bad as an industry about like investing time in that way. It's like, no, get it done now. Get it done now. Get it done now.
So, yeah. I mean, we're very good at accumulating technical debt, which is really what we're talking about, you know, versus buying
just
that
doing stuff manually over and over again because it's faster right now. But yeah.
Right.
Other items that are in demand, application and product security specialists, senior incident response, forensic folks. And I didn't see in the list, but I have to imagine cloud security is probably in fair demand these days.
Yeah, that was actually mentioned. Venture and security mentioned that.
All right, so Ben Rothke didn't, but then, all right. So, and you can't solve these gaps with boot camps. You solve them by taking experienced employees and developing them deliberately, but who does that anymore?
Well, no one who has time.
No one has the time. Yeah. Another item that I saw was ghost jobs. The author mentions hearing from a recruiter who contacted a CISO for a recruiting contract. The CISO told him that the open roles were fakes. I don't know that actually happened, but
I don't know what CISO would admit to that.
Yeah. Yeah. But there has been a lot of talk around ghost jobs recently where a company posts a job it's not hiring for in order to pull resumes. They've already hired someone but left the listing up. They're trying to show investors they're growing. I saw that called out in an article where hedge funds are trying to get ahead of stock announcements by checking the number of open roles at a company and see if the number of open roles is increasing or decreasing so they can decide whether to short the stock price or not.
How do they see that over time? They must be querying these things on a regular basis. Yeah. Then that might be an opportunity for some organization to keep track of that over time.
Some people say they didn't have to. Or trying to scare current employees into producing more. I don't know about that last one.
That doesn't make sense.
It was mentioned in the article, but yeah.
I mean, if your company opened another job position, you'd be like, oh no, they're going to hire another position.
I guess it depends on if the job description matches your job exactly. You're like, I don't know. So, but this seems like a lot of work for not a lot of return. Now, this was from a Stack Overflow blog that'll be linked in the job in the show notes. But they even said that they are interviewing candidates for these ghost jobs, which is such a waste of time.
Well, it's not only a waste of time for the candidate, but it's a waste of time for the company. Why would they spend hours interviewing people that they're never going to hire?
I don't know.
That's a waste of money.
I guess the question is, what level is it a ghost job? Did like the VP decide like, okay, we can, because I can see another reason for it is you make the team happy because they're like, oh, we've got too much work going on. They're like, all right, we'll hire somebody. And they put up a job that they don't, and this still seems like so much work.
It seems so weird. Because yeah. If you post that on LinkedIn jobs or et cetera, that costs money to do that too.
Yeah. It was mentioned as well that HR is incredibly unsuited to find cybersecurity talent.
Well, they're unsuited for a lot of things.
Lee Kushner, a recruiter interviewed by Ben Rothke, states that most HR departments do not actually understand the jobs that they post. And they use certs as a stand-in for actual knowledge, yep. And that's why Then the college diploma. I worked at a job that did not require more than a high school, not even a high school level worth of knowledge. Like I could have done it in high school. And they required you to have a college degree just because the hiring manager said, I'm not hiring anybody unless they have a college degree.
Well, I think this is some place where I think AI could be very helpful in doing that screening instead of HR.
Yeah. Doing tests, like having people show their knowledge.
And then having the AI evaluate the output.
Yeah.
Well, you could use it also to screen the candidate resumes to begin with, too.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were talking about.
The second article from CrankySec, they bring up that a company's security team is a symbol of an untruth that the company thinks cybersecurity is important, so others will believe that the company thinks it's important.
Marketing, messaging.
Now, the other two articles also mention that cybersecurity is a cost center, is frequently cut or limited in budget due to this. Now, I partially agree with this. It kind of relates to what Bruce Schneier said years ago, that security is both a thing and a feeling. You can be secure without feeling it, and you can also feel secure without being secure. And I think this goes too far, though, in saying that cybersecurity team is only a token when most teams do actually do actual concrete things that protect people and property. But because this is imperfect, does that mean that they're not valuable or that the company does not really care if they are secure or not?
Yeah, I would wager this varies from company to company. I imagine like regulated companies and like Fortune 200 companies or 500 companies are probably pretty serious about security because they have to like do the SEC reporting and stuff. But I imagine a lot of smaller companies just don't care. But they probably can't afford it anyways.
Well, you're also starting to see the lawsuits or the regulatory action in saying that cybersecurity statements by companies and executives
are promises
that they're not actually fulfilling, which is they're determining it's fraud.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, and also, of course, this is a deliberately inflammatory blog that I think just says outlandish things to get a response and kind of is like rage catharsis. So I would take them as generally serious, but not 100% true statements.
Yeah, I mean, the author seems to think that, you know, corporate failures are not punished to a sufficient degree that he would like, and individuals whose data is stolen are not adequately reimbursed. He also seems to feel unappreciated and undercompensated.
Which is funny, because I look at how much security folks are paid, and then I look at how much like teachers and garbage men and cops are paid and firemen are paid, and I'm like, who's being overpaid here? Who's being underpaid? But sure.
Yeah. Who's underappreciated? Yeah. But I personally see this, you know, the market is a miraculous thing. You know, if left to its own devices, it will price things very close to their value. That includes cybersecurity services. I mean, you can disagree.
Yeah, I think the market has shown that cybersecurity really isn't worth much. What's interesting to me is that doing IT correctly, with correctly patching and quickly patching, implementing least privilege, et cetera, would reduce cybersecurity vulnerability and breaches by, I don't know, maybe 90%. But the business has also decided that it's not worth that either.
Right.
So they would rather pay an additional security team to try and secure what IT did wrong than pay IT to do it correctly.
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to just the general high time preference that virtually everybody seems to be.
Fast, do it now.
Right. Oh. High time preference is really what causes technical debt. And everybody seems to be guilty of this high time preference. And I'm not sure if this is something that would have been better in the past. And I'm not sure what needs to change in order to lower that time preference. But that's essentially the problem that we're dealing with, is high time preference across both IT and security.
Yeah. And I mean, there's always the fact that a breach typically only means a momentary blip of your stock and some consultant and overtime costs, unless you're SolarWinds.
Have you checked their stock price lately?
I was just thinking that.
I haven't. I think the last time I looked, it was at 10 bucks or something. Which
it's
is down
buying opportunity.
Which is down from like 36, I think it was at the high.
They're 1286.
Okay. Not completely going under yet.
I mean their high was like 25.
Okay.
Back in 2021.
Yeah, so they're still down over 50% from before.
It's on the way back up. Good buying.
You really gotta zoom in on that to see it go back up.
It was under 10 for a while. It was like 8 for a while. So it's up 50% from that. Jeez.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do to recover. I mean, like you said, that was 2021, so that's been 3 years that they've been punished for this.
Look at CrowdStrike. It's going back up, too. Like, it took a hit. It went down from nearly 400 to 200 and some. It went down almost 50%, but it's up 21% this year.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of...
Wow. That actually is wild. I mean, it was just over, it was like 250 at the beginning of the year. So it's still up overall for the year because it was so low at the beginning of this year. So they lost almost all their progress from this year. That's very interesting.
Now, what's interesting about that whole thing is that CrowdStrike and SolarWinds are both very good at what they do. And yet CrowdStrike is not being punished to the level that service or
it did take
SolarWinds was.
Yeah, because SolarWinds, it took off 75% of their stock, mid-20s to 8 is like 75%. And CrowdStrike lost almost 50%, but they're bouncing back a lot faster.
Yeah, and the thing is that I think, from my perspective, I think CrowdStrike was more in the wrong than SolarWinds because they were not doing industry best practices as far as
testing,
staggered rollout and testing. Yeah. Whereas SolarWinds, they just got, they got compromised.
By an APT.
And not necessarily through their own.
By an actual advanced actor.
Right.
Not just some script kiddie.
And not gross negligence. They're being punished way more than CrowdStrike.
Interesting.
But I partially agree with the compensation for folks that who've had their data stolen and then that data was then used to cause harm for them. The problem is that most people's data is stolen are not harmed by it, at least not in ways that are apparent. Many people's data that has been lost or stolen so many times that who do you punish or force to pay?
If your data was leaked three times, like which one was the one the attacker picked up? You have no idea.
I was caught in the OPM breach, so the Chinese know pretty much everything about me, but also I was in the, what was that creditor one?
Experian,
the latest one with that data broker. So, who do you force to pay when everybody's data has been lost or stolen so many times?
Yeah. I like the framing of this as an externality. I think that's how companies consider it. It seems similar to kind of pollution. Like you blow smoke up a smokestack and it's not your problem anymore. It's someone else's problem, maybe. Like, was it that particular, plant, the pollution that caused grandma's cancer? Probably not. So same with the data breaches. Like they just happen and now they're somebody else's problem.
Yeah, well, I think I have a workable idea, but I'm not sure exactly how it would be implemented. Maybe through an insurance company. I'm not sure, but here's the idea. Any company who has lost or stolen data, who has lost or stolen data must pay into a fund based on what was lost and how much of it was lost. And maybe this could be an annual fee, like a membership or something like that.
It's the Costco of insurance.
Maybe. So anyone who could show harm, with ID theft or something like that from data loss can then make a claim against that fund and be adequately compensated for the harm that happened to them due to that data theft.
Yeah, I see this. You're having everybody pay into the same pot, and then when you have a ID theft, you're getting paid out of that same pot. So
right.
You don't have to deal with a specific company. You don't have to go to Experian and be like, Experian, you caused this.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter.
Right. You say that collectively, because those organizations lost data, they're collectively at fault. And then they pay into this fund in order to recoup people from that. And then the manager of this fund will go through some kind of process to evaluate the claim and then pay the victim their restitution full. The degree to which they were harmed.
Yeah. I agree that the only way to correct this is to make companies pay, because that's the only thing that companies understand.
Right.
If you hit their, you have to hit their profit. Now, ideally, I would like for them to pay the amount of money that represents the impact accurately, but that's impossible. So I think your idea makes more sense as an actual workable solution.
Yeah. You can say that, that's the thing is that it's kind of like an average. The more you lost, the greater detail that was lost, the more you have to pay into the fund.
And if they had an amount of money that they had to pay per identity loss, then the company can make some actual business decisions on how much to spend to protect it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that also benefits them, because then they can calculate the risk to the loss.
If this database is lost, it will cost us this many millions of dollars.
To pay into this fund, right. Yeah. Exactly.
I met a company at Black Hat that does something like that. They look at all the published costs of data breaches, and then they map out all of your data, and they list it out by you have 20 million PHI records, the average cost per PHI record for a settlement is this many dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So they allow you to kind of estimate that, but it's done through settlements and previous, which people sometimes inflate and is not always accurate, but
But that's only telling them, you know, this could happen versus,
yeah.
you know, a so, definitive thing.
Where, yeah. which is if you this lose this database, this will cost you $5 million. Therefore, spending $500,000 to protect it might make sense.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know, 10%, 1%, whatever they decide.
Or you could say that, you know, if you lose this database, you are going to have to pay into this fund, period, this amount.
That's a, that's
exactly.
All right, one item you didn't mention that bugs me a bit is not actually about information security. It's about the, there's a comment in this article about engineers working on ad campaigns. They make $500,000 a year. And I was reading another blog discussing kind of the parasite culture, not the parasite economy. I looked at parasite economy, that's a different thing. That's like a libertarian thing. The parasite culture, about how many of the biggest tech companies don't actually create anything of value. They create a marketplace and then skim off the top. Example, TikTok. TikTok doesn't create anything. It just provides you a place for influencers to create stuff. Yeah, Airbnb, they don't build anything. They just have a marketplace for you to share what you already have. Uber and Lyft, they just create a marketplace where you connect people.
Well, it's like and a platform as a service.
Platform as a service. And I think that's deserving of money. I just don't know if that's deserving of the like 30 to 70% they take off the top. Like Uber takes like 70% of what you pay and then gives the driver like 20% of it.
Yeah.
Wow, that's.
I'm wondering what the problem is, whether it's regulatory or it's cost or
how
what.
How can they be taking in so much money and not make money?
Well, the thing is that, you know, if they're taking in that much, why are we not seeing more competitors to bring in a platform that is charging less? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
There are, but really they're small and regional.
If it is overvalued, why is the market not bringing that cost down?
I actually talked with a driver. I don't know if this is in Chicago or somewhere. I was on a business trip and he mentioned there was a different ride sharing app that gave the drivers more. And I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. Like, I should look into that. But it was only for like Chicago. So like you had to know, it's like for a traveler who's flying in, you wouldn't know.
Right.
So apparently there are some smaller regional ones. I don't know how common they are, but.
Well, you got to hope that regional one is going to
get big enough,
to be able to expand.
So, but that's a different conversation for a different podcast. So there are a number of other interesting comments in the Venture and Security article that aren't directly related to the skill shortage, although they're tangential and they're echoes many of the things we've already mentioned, but are more kind of related to the business of cyber. So for example, he comments that most incidents happen not because of some quote grand strategic miscalculation unquote, but instead bad IT. Misconfigs, unpatched vulns, tools and controls that don't work the way you think they do. And I hate to say I told you so, but if only you had some way to automatically test those controls across the environment in a consistent way.
Man, if someone just invent that.
Someone just invent that tool, that would be amazing. At least two of the articles mention the point about how a company doesn't actually know if its tools and employees are good. Because if you're not breached, that could be because you're doing great work. Or it could be because you got lucky this year. Like they didn't get you this year.
Yeah, you happen to blend in his background.
Yeah, you just didn't stand out and nobody hit you. Yeah. But the opposite side is you could have great controls over 90% of the environment, but that cloud environment that somebody stood up could still get popped and your CISO could still get fired.
Right.
Yeah. You and the other gazelle are frozen in the tall grass and you sneeze, you know? Yeah. And that's it.
That's it. He also mentions that feedback loops tend to take years, so it's difficult to tell if a decision made today was good or bad until years go by. And in comparison to manufacturing, if you're working on the line, you can see if someone's doing a good job almost immediately. Like they're going through the line, and the next guy keeps throwing stuff back for quality defects. Like, you know, you're like, all right, you're an idiot, get off the line.
Right.
You're fired. Although, of course, larger items like airlines can still take, or airplanes can still take a few years. Boeing. Yeah. He talks about some other broken talent pipelines. Three of them he gives examples of are product managers. Similar to security engineers, it's not an entry-level job, requires a knowledge of a lot of areas. It's a high-risk hire. If you hire a bad product manager and drive your product into the ground, that's a problem. A venture capital, there's a mismatch between supply and demand. Venture capital firms tend to stay very lean. He actually mentioned that apparently most venture capital firms are only allowed to spend 1% a year or something like that on their expenses. So even if it's like a $5 million fund or a $50 million fund, they only have like $500,000 a year to spend on expenses. And it turns out that doesn't hire very many people. Like that doesn't pay very many travel expenses.
I was thinking on the other side about how many things they invest in versus the risk, the return.
There's
on
also
those.
That too. Yeah, some stuff they invest in just doesn't.
Well, isn't it like 10 to 1 or something like that? They do
they
10 investments for every one return.
In addition, very long feedback loops. It may take 5 or 10 years to figure out if your investment was good. Software engineering, tech companies have cut hiring by over 50%. the interest rates increasing has forced them to stop expanding so fast, stop hiring. And it usually takes 6 to 12 months to get entry-level engineer up to speed, also similar to cybersecurity. The main difference is software engineering. Hiring more software engineers leads to you making more money, potentially, whereas hiring more cybersecurity engineers...
Yeah, they're not a call center.
Yeah. Part of the broken pipeline is training and development aspect. Seems like almost no company has like a development program for cybersecurity. For example, many companies have defined plans where you identify folks who are going to be business leaders and you give them a business rotation. They spend 6, 12, 18 months in finance, a year or two on the manufacturing floor. You get over to marketing, you get a broad knowledge of business. And I've never seen this for security.
Well, that's something that is actually mentioned in the Phoenix Project. You know, the main character of that story goes into one of those programs at the end to eventually become the CEO, or with the expectation that he will eventually become the CEO. Yeah.
And they have this at multiple levels. I've heard of this being done at like entry level, where you come out of college and you spend a rotation doing around stuff. And then I've also heard it when you're identified as like a up and coming manager in your 20s or 30s, and like they see executive potential in you and they do a different but similar type of program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always the impact of automation that'll reduce manual tasks and entry level roles first, so even less entry level roles. But we've talked about that a lot, so I'm not going to go into any detail there.
Well, I mean, it's like the promise of automation has been around for how long now?
I mean, it's been 7 years since SOAR came out, and then there was always the coding stuff before that. So for the fact, it is interesting. We haven't talked about it yet, but there's been this big thing recently called about SOAR is dead, and how SOAR is a feature, not a product, and it's being folded into a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the SIM is starting to pull. It's like a black hole. It's just pulling in more and more other parts.
And SOAR... It's always been way more complicated than they sell it to you. As they sell, it's a low, no code. You can, your analyst can put it together. And that has never turned out to be true. Poor employer retention. We just mentioned part of this, but companies do a terrible job at keeping employees. Most people seem to rotate jobs every 1 to 2 years, and it takes up to 12 months to learn a job.
I can't believe that people are switching jobs that quickly, though.
So the article said most, I think. But I don't think it's most. I would say that maybe a quarter to a third of the resumes that I see are like rapid job switchers. So I think there's like a core group of people that are, I think that makes more sense in the beginning of your career too, and less sense the more and more senior you get.
Right. So, well, I mean, that also kind of negates the whole conversation we're having here about the fact there are no openings. There are no openings, but it'd be that easy to switch that rapidly.
I don't know that it is anymore. So one of the things that I was actually thinking about looking at this is I think that the way the environment is now, I think that like 5 years ago, 2 years ago, it was very easy for senior people to switch. And I think now it's gotten a lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
So, So I'm curious why companies are so bad about this. There's been a ton of research about how to keep employees and the benefits of keeping employees, but companies either don't seem to care or they've done their own cost-benefit analysis or research and determined that the research is wrong. It actually is fairly low impact to constantly have to retrain folks and absorb the gaps in employment.
Well, I mean, this is also related to what we just talked about a little bit ago with the high time preference. You know, it's just not-
Move fast, do it now.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And not worrying about the long-term prospects of anything, including, employee retention.
Yeah, maybe. So in conclusion, there is a cybersecurity skills gap, but it's for senior and specific roles, not for entry level. Schools and boot camps are preying on young people's desire to get a comfortable, well-paying job and lying to them about the availability of that job.
Yeah, and I think eventually this is going to flush out. And just like the MCIS, the MCSE.
Lawyers. Yeah, now the average lawyer apparently only makes $50,000. Like there are definitely high-paid lawyers at well-paying law firms, right. So like the vast majority of them don't make much.
Yeah, I mean, but Well, maybe not every, but a lot of the folks who go into law school think they're going to come out Matlock and not Better Call Saul. But that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at Surrogate on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.